Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
When you read a book by today's guest, you'll never look at birds the same way again. Chico State retired professor Roger Lederer has served on the boards of the local science fair and nature center. He has traveled to 100 countries and has been a guest speaker and naturalist on several cruise lines across the world, speaking on ecology, natural history, and geology. Through his website, ornithology.com, he has been consulted by the BBC, National Geographic, National Public Radio, and the Guinness Book of World Records and other organizations and individuals. He has published over 30 scientific research papers and 8 books, including the recent Latin for Bird Lovers with his wife, retired English professor Carol Burr, and the locally popular Field Guide to the Birds of Bidwell Park, illustrated by Professor Burr. Professor Lederer now has a new book, Beaks, Bones, and Bird Songs, How the Struggle for Survival Has Shaped Birds and Their Behavior. Roger Lederer, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, when we call somebody a bird brain, it's not a compliment. So, did you used to think that way?
Well, for a long time, certainly when I was a kid, until I started studying birds. And even after I started studying birds, I thought maybe, yeah, they're not really as smart as mammals, but we've found differently.
Well, I was always interested in zoology. I loved biology when I was in high school. I majored in college. But birds were not on my radar screen. I really didn't think about birds one way or another. I didn't think about studying them any depth. So at what point did you decide birds were worthy of study?
Well, actually, when I was in high school, I raised tropical fish, and that was my first love, fish. I wanted to be an ichthyologist. And in fact, I'm raising tropical fish right now as a hobby. Well, I got back into it. But at that time, I went to college, and I decided I was going to be an ichthyologist. But the guy who taught ichthyology, frankly, wasn't very good. I happened to take a course in ornithology with a wonderful instructor who really just turned me around. He didn't do it purposely, but he was such a good instructor that I respected him a lot. And then I ended up teaching ornithology as a graduate student, and it was just very easy. It was very obvious for me that's what I wanted to go into.
Well, you mentioned that this particular teacher influence your choice, because I just imagine you have been that kind of teacher, because I can see that on every page of your book, I say, this guy loves teaching.
Well, one of my reviews said I'm a born teacher. I don't know about that, but I did get an email, interesting, from my first graduate student who left here in the late 70s, went on to become a professor at University of New Hampshire, and then he's traveled the world as an educational consultant. And he went on and on with all his major accomplishments and ended up with saying, thanks for giving me, a young guy, a great break 40 years ago. So, and I know some of my other students feel like that too. So that makes me happy to see them be so successful.
And with your specialty, well, you can retire from teaching college students, but you can continue to be a teacher. I mentioned that you go on cruise lines. Recently, I went to a lecture you gave at the Nature Center in Chico, and I was making notes like crazy, thinking, wow, this is so interesting. And so you still can play that role as teacher.
Oh, I still do that. I talk to Boy Scouts and the Master Gardener group, and as you said, Audubon, and I'm going to speak at the Swan Festival, and I gave a field trip the other day to one woman who bought my field trip at the science fair fundraiser. And I've done a number of those kinds of things. It's just not making any money on it, but that's okay. I enjoy going out and I enjoy showing people those kinds of things.
My guest is retired professor, Roger Lederer, and he's written 8 books. His most recent is Beaks, Bones, and Bird Songs, How the Struggle for Survival Has Shaped Birds and Their Behavior. So when we think about birds surviving, we don't think it's a full-time occupation, I don't think, because we see the birds are sitting on this branch, they're singing, and think, oh, that's a nice life the birds have. Is that really the case?
That's what people think. They see birds, the bluebird of happiness and the dove of peace and all those kinds of things. And they're happily chirping as they hop around the ground or flit from branch to branch. But when you look at them closely, birds have a very tenuous life. They've got to be in perfect condition all the time. Mammals can break a leg, lose a paw, you know, be blind in one eye, lose an ear, those kinds of things. And, you know, some of them can still get along. But birds, rarely does that happen, and they survive. Some ground-dwelling birds can lose a foot or a toe. But mostly, if they break a wing, if they lose a leg and they're perching birds, they just aren't going to survive. If they get sick, they die very quickly. I mean, cholera, bird botulism, bird malaria wipes out birds very quickly. And in the case of West Nile virus, it hurt some birds. They didn't react too much to them except for crows and jays. Crows and jays got West Nile virus, and 100% of them died if they contracted it. They're just now coming back. So it's a tenuous life. And if you look at what they call survivorship curves, you look at human beings, we keep going along pretty well until we're about 60. And then we start to, you know, struggle a little bit with this and aches and pains and those kinds of things. And we hit about 75, which I did yesterday. they start to decline a little bit. And pretty soon, you know, by 90, most of us are gone. A few people might live to be 110, but that's pretty rare. In the case of birds, they go along perfectly until whatever they're, you know, like a robin. A robin lives about 2.5 years on average. A robin will live just perfectly at 2.5 years old and then die off just like that. Well, any little sickness, any little injury, they're gone. But before they're gone, they're perfect.
Well, I happen to know an older gentleman approaching his 100th birthday who just feels like this deterioration of his health is just something he's not enjoying at all, to say the least. And so I think somebody like that, and a lot of us, might envy birds. They live a healthy life, and then if something happens, that's it. They don't have to suffer this decline that we humans go
right,
through.
That's the way we all hope we go, real good until we're dead.
Yeah. But you say in your introduction, birds have to be on task all the time. They have to use their senses to find food, migrate, withstand the weather, avoid predators, and compete with each other and alien species, and face a myriad of other trials. And that's what your book is about.
Yes. If you look at songbirds, the average songbird, that's 54% of all birds are songbirds. The average songbird lives between 1 and 3 years, which doesn't sound like much to us. Everybody thinks they live a lot longer than that. And you can find, for instance, a robin that might live to be 10 years old. But just like humans living to be 110 years old, that's a rarity. Most robins live about 2.5 years. Now, what happens if they lay 5 or 6 eggs in a nest? The chances of one of those eggs becoming an adult robin and laying eggs in another nest a year later is about 15%. So 1 out of maybe 6 eggs makes it. And then the chances of that robin becoming 2 years old and having another brood of young is 40%. You put those two together, the chances of an egg becoming a 2-year-old adult are about 6%. So that's not much. So the question is, how do they do it? Well, you know, sometimes they have 2 or 3 broods, but somehow they do it. I mean, they're very good at surviving. That's what evolution has done for them, make them good at that kind of surviving. Bigger birds live longer. Albatrosses might live 40 or 50 years at most, but they have to be 5 or 10 years old before they breed. They lay only 1 egg every other year, so it's sort of a trade-off.
Well, in your introduction, you mentioned they have senses to find food, migrate, withstand the weather, and so on. So that's where I would like to ask you about the various senses that birds have, because just like we have this expression, bird brain, we also have the expression eagle-eyed.
Right.
So I think most would probably say, oh, well, birds have good eyesight. Is that true?
Birds have excellent eyesight. On average, they see twice as well as we can. That is, they can see twice as far and still keep things in focus. They can see twice as close and keep things in focus. They can see things moving at a faster rate than we can. So something whizzes by when you're in a car. You know, a bird could probably see that in focus. Well, we can't. We have flicker, it's one thing called flicker fusion. That is, remember the old Charlie Chaplin movies? You'd see Charlie Chaplin or these other guys walking around very jerkily. And that's because they filmed the films at 16 frames per second. And our eyesight is good enough that we can distinguish between each frame. And so it looked very jerky because we'd see just basically a bunch of simple pictures one after another. But then the frames went to 24 frames a second. And everything fused. That's our flicker fusion. So there was no more flicker, and we all fused. So Charlie Chaplin or whoever else it was, move very smoothly. Well, birds' flicker fusion is 100 frames per second,
wow,
if we look at it that way. So they can see things when they're flying through the branches and they're seeing an insect flying by or a peregrine falcon chasing a sparrow. They can keep a good track of it without things going out of focus. One of the downsides of that is that when birds are kept under fluorescent lights, they can see them flickering because fluorescent lights flicker at 80 times a second. We can't see that, but they can. Apparently it doesn't bother them, but that's what we perceive of the birds. And they can focus a lot faster than we can as well. So if something moves very quickly, they can accommodate their lens moves in such a way that they can see everything in focus all the time.
So there's another reason to envy birds. One, the fact that they don't have any physical decline. They live their life and then they die. And the other is this fantastic eyesight that they have. But their eyes are different from ours in a lot of ways. And you mentioned that that various factors influence the size of the eyes.
Right. All birds' eyes are pretty big compared to ours. They're much bigger than ours are. They take up a lot of the head. And they can also see, in general, they can see almost all the way around them. They can see, because their eyes are on the side of their head, except, you know, like hawks and owls. But a pigeon, for instance, can see 270 degrees from one side to the other side. Now, they can't focus on it real well, but they can see. We can't see behind our head. They can, but because our eyes are in front. Now, owls, on the other hand, have their eyes right in front because they're standing there looking at something or looking for something, and they've got giant eyes. Their eyes take up almost half of their skull outside of the brain. And so they're picking up a lot of light, and they need to have that focus right in front, but they don't have peripheral vision, so they can turn their head 270 degrees, which we can't.
Well, one thing that I was shocked by is the fact that their eyes are so big, you can see their eyes by looking in their ear. You can look in an owl's ear and see the back of their eye.
Most people don't even know where birds' ears are, but if you
they don't have that external ear that we
have. If you have a pet parakeet or cockatiel or something like that, you can blow on the side of the head and you'll see a hole in the head, and that's where their ear hole is. Owls have ears a little bit like ours, but again, if you look right in that ear hole, yes, you can see the back of the eye because the eye is so big.
My guest is retired Professor Roger Lederer, and he has a new book, Beaks, Bones, and Bird Songs, How the Struggle for Survival Has Shaped Birds and Their Behavior. So keen eyesight is one thing that helps them survive. They have varying eyes depending on what they need to survive as the type of bird that they are. And you mentioned that some birds have flat eyes.
Flat eyes, they're ones that are seeing, like just looking at the horizon, like a lot of shorebirds. They don't need to see a lot of detail. They just need to see in the distance. And they don't need to see up very much. They need to see a little bit down, but they're picking at things right in front of their nose. And so all they need to do is keep focused on, you know, the horizon and the food in front of them. And they don't need to see other things in detail.
And then you mentioned tubular eyes. I've never thought of that.
Well, that's the owls. The owls have tubular eyes, and they're in a bony socket. Sort of, they're called sclerotic rings, a whole series of bony rings that keep the eye in a tubular shape. And that really focuses whatever they see in really fine detail.
Most of us know that dogs, for example, have a wider range of hearing than we humans do. But you also describe how birds have a wider range of color than we humans do.
Birds can see color just like we do, but they can see more colors, you know, within the blue range or the red range or the yellow range. I don't know, forget them. We can distinguish maybe 2,000 different colors. Birds can distinguish more than that. We don't know exactly how many because it's very hard to test them to find out.
I would
out
think
whether,
so. You know, whether you can't just ask the bird,
yeah,
what do you see?
They know the difference between battleship gray and sand gray or things like that, but they're the finer distinction. But they also can see ultraviolet, which is something that was just discovered in the last 20 years or so.
Now, you're mentioning that also makes this feel so exciting, Roger, because a lot of fields, you write your dissertation, you have to scratch to find something that nobody has found before, whereas your field, just very recently I read some of it in your book that you didn't know until the 1960s. They didn't know this about birds, or here's something that was found in 2011 that was not known about birds before. So this I find really exciting, that there's always something new you're learning that we didn't know about birds before.
Part of it is, like all science, we've got new technology. We've got new equipment, new ways of looking at things, ways of measuring things. And so that helps a lot, too. And the stuff we used to use is becoming cheaper. In addition to things like putting radios on birds to see where they flew, used to be really did that in the 50s and 60s, but it was very expensive. Now it's relatively cheap. So that... But one of the problems is that you can't keep all birds in captivity. There are only some that do well in captivity. So we have a lot of our research being done on pigeons, on sparrows, on starlings, things like that that do well in captivity. And they probably do reflect adaptations of birds in general. But we know there are a lot of birds that have very special adaptations that we just can't test right now.
So, for example, we did not know about birds being able to detect ultraviolet in the color spectrum.
Right. But then when we figured that out, and then, you know, they figured it out, well, what's the issue now is why are they using ultraviolet? Okay, we know they can see ultraviolet because you shine ultraviolet light and they respond to it.
So that's nice, but what good is it? What good does it do to
the bird? Yeah, exactly. Why are they seeing ultraviolet? Well, we know one is that sometimes they track their prey. I gave an example the other night. Then you heard the European kestrel tracks its vole prey, that little mouse-like thing running around the ground, because the vole marks its territories with urine, and the fresher the urine, the more ultraviolet light it reflects. And so it finds its prey that way. It's probably true that a lot of birds find their prey with different kinds of ultraviolet. Maybe it's plants, maybe it's insects, maybe it's something else, but that's a good speculation. And the other part is that they may be able to, a lot of birds look alike. I mean, the males and females are called monochromatic because they're the same color. So to our eyes, so we can't tell this male from that female like a meadowlark. Meadowlark males and females look alike. But they probably can, where you shine lights, ultraviolet lights on them, and they reflect different amount of ultraviolet light. So perhaps the birds are telling other birds sex, age, whether they're flirting with them or whatever else happens to be, by how much they're reflecting.
So they can find their prey by ultraviolet, by seeing, being able to see ultraviolet light. They can find a mate using ultraviolet light. And also, I found this so interesting, too, that if you have a little nest of birds, several birds, and some of them are getting fed plenty and they're thriving, and then the poor little guy who's not thriving gives off more ultraviolet light.
Well, in the case of a couple of birds that have been tested, European roller and starling, we know that's true, that the young birds have got a little ultraviolet mark on their forehead that shows up if they're not getting enough food, and so the parent knows to feed that bird more than the other ones.
That's just amazing.
Probably true for lots of other birds too, but again, we have to test it. We have to find the birds. We've got to get in their, you know, their nests and their young and so on. It's technically as difficult.
Well, there are probably other ways that birds detect use the fact that they can detect ultraviolet light
Could be using it from migration. We don't know.
My guest is Professor Roger Lederer, and he has written a new book, Beaks, Bones, and Bird Songs. And we have just been talking about the fact that but their eyesight is very good. And one thing that I found interesting, because I grew up being nearsighted, was the fact that some birds can change that. Some birds are nearsighted, some birds are farsighted, and they can even change that if necessary.
They can change it very quickly, especially, well, a good example is a kingfisher is farsighted, sitting up in a branch 20 feet above the water. It's going to be farsighted to see that fish down there, but as soon as it enters the water, light doesn't go very well through water. It gets out of focus very quickly. So he need to be nearsighted underwater, and they can change it like 1/5 of a second. So as soon as they hit the water, they're nearsighted. As soon as they leave the water, they're farsighted.
That's an amazing thing about birds. And also, I understand that dogs don't see color, but birds definitely see color. They're beautiful colors themselves. But you say that they have oil droplets in their cone cells. You might explain why rods and cones, what role they play in sight.
Well, we all have, you and I have rods and cones, and the rods detect black and white. They detect contrast, and the cones detect color. And birds have the same kinds of rods and cones, but they also have the cones for ultraviolet. But, the oil droplets, it found in most birds, but especially in water-dwelling birds, the oil droplets serve as polarizing lenses. Now, we know if you've ever been in a science class, you can use a microscope, a light microscope, up to a certain point. At about 1,000 magnification, everything goes blurry. But you can use it. You can put a drop of oil between the slide and the microscope, and it polarizes the light, and so you can see at higher magnifications. And then they have microscopes for that called oil immersion lenses. So it's the same principle. Birds have polarizing lenses in their cones.
So it's like they have their own sunglasses, and then some have their own visors. The old bony thing that comes out that helps.
With soaring hawks that are looking down for something. That's what gives them that ominous look, that little eye shades on there that actually keeps the light from interfering with their eyes as they're going down, which is why I guess football players do the same thing, only underneath their eyes.
Mm-hmm. But that black...
a little black smudge.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned that a second ago that their hearing is also very keen. They have very keen eyesight. And... for example, we see a robin cock his head to the side, and we think, oh, that robin's listening to what's in the ground. And you say, no, he's not listening.
Well, that's been an urban myth for years. Birds are putting their head back and forth as if they were listening for worms. And in fact, where was it? Somebody wrote me asking if birds can detect flatulation of worms, that worms give off gas, and that's what the birds are hearing. Well, that's not true. What they're doing is they're cocking their head, just like a golfer cocks his head to look at where the ball is lying. That's just to see things around it and figure out where their prey is.
So the robin is turning his head not because he's using his ears, his hearing so much, but his
vision. Yeah, just using his eyeballs, right?
Well, you make the point that sometimes if you have a group of people and you ask for a volunteer to, because we have stereo, we have an ear on each side of our head, that we can usually tell. If you were to snap your fingers over to my left, I would be able to tell that you were snapping your fingers to my left. But if I close my eyes, there's a place you can snap your fingers that I wouldn't be able to tell. And that's what you've done in this little test.
That's right. I do that sometimes in my presentations, and somebody in the front row, usually I'll just snap my fingers in the plane of their head. So it's a sagittal plane right through their nose and the back of their head. So I snap my fingers in front of their nose and back of their head or above their head. And because your ears hear things equally, you can't really locate it. So most of the time people don't get it. It's a 1 out of 3 guess. Sometimes they do. One woman at a OLLI presentation I gave about 5 or 6 years ago, I snapped my finger and she got it. And I snapped my finger again. She said, do it again. So I did, and she got it twice. I said, that's really unusual. I said, is your hearing, especially acute? And she says, I'm blind.
Ah.
So I really didn't expect a blind person to be attending my slideshow lectures, but she was. But her hearing has been more acute because that's the only major sense she has now.
In fact, I have a friend who is blind. I mean, she has no vision at all, beautiful artificial eyes, but her hearing is so acute, and she loves imitating bird songs.
Hmm.
So that surprised you then, that somebody whose sense of sight is diminished has a more acute sense of hearing, apparently, from your...
apparently, my experience, yeah.
Well, that brings up the point, then, if birds are using their hearing, some birds sing, why do they sing? I mean, it's very pleasant for us. I love listening to birds sing, but what do they get out of it?
Well, I mean, with the birds that do sing, and these are among the songbirds, and not all songbirds sing. I mean, crows and jays are considered songbirds, but they don't sing. And there's other birds that have sounds, but they don't really sound very melodious.
Well, that's one sound that I can understand, a crow's sound. It's not a song, but it's a distinctive sound.
It's a songbird,
one of the few
but it's
that
a different,
I can identify.
Different group of songbirds. But songbirds that do have, like song sparrows and warblers and so on, that do have nice songs, it's obviously communication, and mostly during springtime when they're attracting mates. They're doing two things. One, they're attracting mates, and they're setting up the territories to keep other males out. I've had a number of people who have got to me, my website or in a lecture, saying, oh, birds sing because they're happy. Well, that's what we think, but that's
it makes us happy.
It makes us happy, but the birds don't sing because they're, and it, you can disprove that because, one, they only spring singing in the springtime or the breeding time, so aren't they happy the rest of the year? Two, it's mostly males that sing, so are all the females depressed? And three, if you sang in the wintertime when there's no breeding going on, all you'd be doing is attracting predators, so it's not a good idea.
Well, the fact that birds are singing and people say, oh, it's because they're happy, but from what you describe, their life is every day survival, so they don't have much reason to be singing because they're happy. They're busy.
They're busy. I don't know if they have an attitude about being happy or sad, but they're definitely focused on survival.
Yeah, so they've got to worry where their next meal is coming from. But what I also found interesting, Roger, in this section about hearing is that, and I never thought about this, ways in which birds communicate without singing, non-vocal communication. And some of this surprised me, like what a woodpecker does. I mean, I know the sound of a woodpecker pecking with his head, but what other sound does he make?
Well, they can squawk. They make other kinds of squawks, too, when they take off. But mostly when they're attracting females or are talking to each other, they're pecking on wood. I mean, they'll make noise otherwise when they're pecking on wood, but probably the best example is northern flickers. Northern flickers really like to make a lot of noise. Now, they'll squawk, but they'll also get on telephone poles, big, big, hollow, or loud telephone poles, wood ones, but even the metal ones, they'll peck on the metal ones. They're not going and making any holes in there. They're not looking for bugs. They're just advertising. And one of these big power poles that's made out of steel really reverberates. They really like that. That's a good way of communicating. Storks do the same thing by clapping their bills. They're just making noises without singing.
Well, you mentioned in your book that woodpeckers drum.
Right. Well, that exactly. It's called drumming.
Well, another thing that surprised me, too, was that I assumed that birds didn't make any noise until after they came out of their shell. But I learned in your book that, no, these little birds, before they even become a duckling or even before they come out of the shell, they're communicating inside their shell. What does a little bird have to say when he's not even born yet, so to speak?
Well, there's two. They've done this, with quail and with waterfowl, with ducks, with geese. Because they're fairly easy to raise. And inside the shell, little birds, when they're just about ready to hatch, will peck for a couple of reasons. One, they'll peck to say, I need more incubation or I need less incubation, so that they all hatch at the same time. With ducks and geese and quail, they might have 10, 15, 20 eggs, and you can't have three of them hatching one day, five the next day, 10 the day after that, because they're all hopping out of the nest. So mom's got to get them all hatched at the same time. So some will say, incubate me more, incubate me less. And also they will peck and say, hey, I'm upside down. And if I start pecking, they have a little egg tooth on the top of their bill. So do snakes, by the way. They have an egg tooth on the top of their bill, and they hit it with their upper jaw and crack open the shell. And if they're upside down, they can't do that. So they'll tell mom, hey, turn me over.
Well, I have so many more questions for you, Professor, because this is just such a fascinating topic, I find. But we are going to take a short break. And when we come back, I'll have some more questions about, for example, echolocation, how birds use that, other talents that birds have, and how they survive extreme heat and cold. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is retired Professor Roger Lederer, whose latest book is Beaks, Bones, and Bird Songs. And he has published quite a few books on the subject, and this newest book is How This Struggle for Survival Has Shaped Birds and Their Behavior. And we were talking about the fact that birds have this acute sense of hearing, but how do they use echolocation?
Well, only a few birds use echolocation. One, the oil bird that lives in South America inside caves, they echolocate very much like bats do. Not quite as sophisticated, but since they're flying in the dark in a cave, they have to find their way around. So it's probably true that a lot of other birds also use echolocation, but we just haven't detected that yet. We do know that some birds make some noises at night that sound like echolocation, but we really don't know. It's hard to, again, technologically, it's hard to find out that information. But we know at least those oil birds do, and probably some swifts that live in the dark caves.
So they have very keen eyesight. They have very keen hearing. What about their sense of smell? Do birds rely on their sense of smell at all?
For a long time, we thought that birds could not smell. In fact, Audubon in the 1800s, you know, did some experiments and decided that, no, vultures couldn't smell. Well, it turns out that they can. Some new experiment, later experiments in the 1950s, 60s, found that vultures can't smell. At least turkey vultures can. Black vultures can't smell. These are North American also, can't smell as well because they eat mostly live stuff. They don't eat as much dead stuff. So turkey vultures having the smell, having a sense of smell, can find dead things that are putting off ethyl mercaptan, which is what decaying bodies do. Smells a little bit like skunk. And in Africa, those vultures can't smell either because they find everything by eyesight. So we know what the vultures can smell. Well, if vultures can smell, can other birds smell? Yeah, we've discovered that other birds have a sense of smell too. Not so much songbirds, although we really don't know yet, but we know that seabirds can smell. A professor at UC Davis, Gabriel Nevitt, discovered that birds can smell this compound put off by crushed plankton. Plankton get eaten by little other zooplankton, and this compound goes up into the air. And those plankton that are there attract fish, and the fish attract the birds. So if the birds smell these crushed plankton, they know there's something going on and there's a lot of fish there. So we know they can smell it, and we know that they probably are using it to migrate around the world by using smell maps.
Well, you know, you said that people didn't think vultures could smell, but I find that hard to believe because what vultures eat, I can't imagine that they couldn't smell that. Also, vultures have adapted to be able to eat stuff that is full of bacteria. That would be very dangerous if we humans were to eat what vultures eat. How do they cope with that?
Well, we wouldn't eat that stuff in the first
no,
place.
It wouldn't.
I mean, it would be pretty disgusting. But the fact is they
our
can't.
Nose would tell us not to do that.
Our nose would tell our eyesight, too, but or in our taste buds. But vultures can eat that stuff because they have a pH of less than 1 in their stomach, so the bacteria just get, you know, just dissolved.
Very acidic.
Very acidic. And they also, they're stepping in the stuff as well. They're getting their head in it. But when they step in it, they also defecate on their legs. And so the high acid content of their urea putting on their legs kills the bacteria.
So they kill the bacteria from their legs. But what about their heads? They're sticking their heads in these dead animals.
Well, their head doesn't have any feathers, so it doesn't accumulate too much stuff. And they sit outside, and you've probably seen them at Bootball Park or other places with their wings spread out. They're letting the sun kill all the bacteria.
So they have ways of disinfecting themselves,
right,
to protect themselves that
exactly.
way. And they see, as well as you say now, we think they do smell. But there's something else that, say, a predator comes along and the buzzard said, oops, I got to get out of here. How does he do that? How does he make a quick takeoff?
Well, because they don't find dead stuff very often, whatever they do find, they gorge themselves on. They might not eat for 2 or 3 days, and then they find a dead skunk, so they eat the whole thing, and they're sitting there, you know, belching and enjoying their meal, and along comes, say, a fox or a coyote, and they can't take off very easily. So they throw up, and they throw up this dead skunk, and that one, it lets them take off with a lighter load, and two, it probably deters the coyote.
So they can make a quick takeoff because they just unload some of their extra
everything.
Weight.
Exactly.
Not one of the more pleasant paragraphs in your book, but
yeah, that's why people don't like turkey vultures. Also, when you said the other myth that this, actually I took at a bird walk the other day, and this person I took said the same thing. Oh, the turkey vultures are circling around out there. It must be something dead. Well, if you think about it, if there was something dead, they wouldn't be circling around.
They'd be down there eating it.
They circle around looking for things, or they're just taking advantage of the wind currents, and so they soar around, covering lots of area, and may find something dead in the meantime.
And isn't that word kettle that's used
right, so
to
a big,
describe that?
Big flock of turkey vultures swirling around is called a kettle.
So if I'm out with some bird watchers and they see what they say, oh, I see a kettle, I'll know what they're talking about.
Right.
They're talking about the vultures circling,
right,
looking for food. Well, you also say that kiwis especially depend on a sense of smell.
Yes. Kiwi birds are very primitive kinds of birds. You know, they have very primitive feathers. They're flightless. They're only nocturnal. They have big bristles on the side of their bill, and they probe mainly for worms. And so they probably smell as well, but they also, and they have nostrils at the tip of their bill. And they also have sense organs all along their bill so they can tell when they hit a worm. And they also have these whiskers, or rictal bristles they're called, but like whiskers of a cat, so they can also find their way around. So they made up for their lack of flight and their lack of good eyesight by all those other kinds of things that help them live in a nocturnal world.
Well, speaking of flightless birds and also that part of the world, you say that ostriches don't put their head in the sand.
No, that's just, well, you know, they might at times if there happens to be a hole, but they don't specifically do that. It's because the desert is rolling, and so there's little hills in there, and someone sees an ostrich at a distance putting their head down for something. They think they put their head in the sand, but they actually have their head just hidden by a little hill of sand.
So some of these expressions that we have about birds are just our own ignorance about birds then, like ostriches not putting their head in the sand, or birds' brain being actually large for their body size.
Right.
Well, so we've talked about the sense of smell then. What about a bird's sense of taste?
Birds don't have a very good sense of taste in general. They can taste sugar. They can taste what we can, but birds have a few hundred taste buds while we have several thousand. If you look at a catfish, maybe has 100,000 taste buds in its mouth, and a bird maybe has 800. I think we have more like 10,000, something like that. So we can distinguish those tastes, but birds can't distinguish. But they can distinguish between levels of sugar. Birds will go to a flower with more sugar than one that less sugar. One reason that it's good that they don't have taste is they can eat hot peppers.
Ooh.
So they can eat, you know, this spray we have for the beer repellent and those kinds of things, or just, you know, eat a jalapeno pepper. You know what it'll do to you? Birds can eat jalapeno peppers. I talked to somebody in Hawaii. He says he tries to grow hot peppers, and the birds are in there eating it all the time. He says, how can they possibly do that? I said, they don't taste it. But it's good for the peppers because that's how the peppers get distributed. They get carried around. The seeds get carried around by the birds and not by mammals who would chew up the seeds.
My guest is Professor Roger Lederer, and he is an ornithologist. His latest book is Beaks, Bones, and Bird Songs: How the Struggle for Survival Has Shaped Birds and Their Behavior. Well, birds, you say that they can taste sugar. And I wonder, when I see hummingbird feeders, and I see that people have, and I assume that it's a sugar water that's in there, but also it's colored red. And I often wonder, gosh, are we doing the birds a favor by putting some kind of coloring in their water?
Well, they are attracted by red, but the fact is you could put blue in there and they will still find it. It might take them a little bit longer, but they are attracted by red. I also get calls or emails from people who say, I have a hummingbird. I keep getting hummingbirds trapped in my garage. And think about that. Why is that? Because we mostly have automatic garage door openers, and we have an emergency cord hanging from them with a little knob on there that's red. And they come in and they see a red flower, and so they're trying to get sugar out of that little knob. I always tell people, spray it black, and that solves the problem.
I would have never thought of that.
Yeah.
Oh my. Well, I do wonder about the fact that isn't that maybe carcinogen for those little birds?
There's there's a lot of rumor about that. There's no evidence. I mean, it does. Some of that red dye is made out of coal tar, which is a carcinogen. But first of all, hummingbirds only live 1 to 3 years. So they're not really going to live long enough to get cancer. Secondly, there's no evidence that it's ever caused cancer in birds. That doesn't mean I encourage it. You don't really have to do it, but it also isn't going to hurt the birds.
Well, you mentioned the color yellow. You say blue is also attractive to birds. But I had never thought about the fact that certain colored fruits appeal more to birds and other colored fruits more to mammals. You say that mammals are more like the yellow, orange, brown fruit, and the birds the red and blue.
Well, remember, mammals, what do they? They tend to chew up stuff, and sometimes they'll eat things that have lots of seeds in them. The seeds will pass through, and that's okay. But if it's a big fruit, they might chew it into pieces, while birds will swallow it whole. So mistletoe, for instance, is distributed by birds. Mockingbirds and lots of and cedar waxwings will eat mistletoe berries, and then they'll fly to another tree and in 20 minutes or so defecate that seed, only now it's covered with a sticky seed coat and it sits on another tree and it gets distributed. So plants have learned to attract certain kinds of birds depending on the seeds they
have. For their own purposes.
For their own purposes.
Well, speaking of this kind of relationship, there are birds that guide humans to honey, and then they get the insects to eat. I think you call them honey guides.
They're called honey guides, right. In fact, family is Indicatoridae, and one of the species is Indicator. So it was named for that particular purpose. And the natives just follow these birds because they typically go to beehives and rip them apart and get the honey. So here, now the natives go and get the honey, and the birds get the leftovers.
And it works out very well for
works
both.
Works out very well, exactly.
So birds have this sense of taste that are not very acute, not like ours. So that's one way we maybe have the edge over the birds. And then the birds are eating these various colored things. But they do, the nectar is appealing to them. And so sometimes the plant attracts the bird saying, I've got sweet nectar for you if you'll come do us a favor and spread the pollen.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, you look at it, 200 million years ago, flowering plants and birds were evolving at about the same time. So they probably coexisted with each other. And there's a lot of birds that, a lot of plants that just, like with long tubular ones, they have tubular flowers where the hummingbirds can stick their bill in there, but no other birds can, and no mammals can get in there. So birds and flowers have co-evolved for many millions of years.
Well, there's one other sense that we haven't talked about, and that is the sense of feel, of touch. And I know that feathers don't have any feeling because you can clip your parakeet's wings and it doesn't hurt him to cut feathers. So do birds feel? If their feathers can't feel, how do birds feel if they do?
Well, they do. I mean, there are senses. Between the feathers are little tiny, if you've ever plucked a chicken or you look really close at a plucked chicken, you'll see little tiny hairs in there. Those are called phyloplumes. And those phyloplumes detect the position of the feathers as the bird's flying through the air. Or when the bird lands, it feels that a feather is out of place, and so it preens itself. So those things detect the position of feathers, which is really important, especially in flight. Birds can also detect in their bills, they can detect food. Some birds can detect food underneath muck and mire of some swamp because they have little corpuscles in their bills. And same thing with their legs, a little bit. But overall, they don't. Their sense of touch isn't as good as ours are.
Well, you mentioned in the water that flamingos turn their heads upside down when they're eating underwater. I never thought of that. So flamingos turn their heads upside down.
They turn their heads upside down. Their tongues are like a big pump, and they have lamellae on their bills, and that lamellae filters out a little microorganisms they eat. And I'll tell you, I've seen flamingos. They inhabit some of the filthiest places I've ever seen. Just god-awful, mucky, smelly places, but somehow they manage to survive.
So they're able to filter it out. But now you mentioned, we talked about feathers, and some birds just eat everything. I mean, some birds actually pluck the feathers off, but owls just gobble up the entire whatever it is they're eating. And so how do they get rid of this part of the animal that they don't want, a bird that they don't want to consume?
owls and some hawks and some grebes that eat fish will just swallow the prey whole. But then they digest everything except the bones or the scales and the feathers and those kinds of things and regurgitate it like a cat regurgitates a hairball. And they're called owl pellets or hawk pellets or grebe pellets. In fact, they sell these things for little kids, you know, in second or third grade to dissect. Commercially, you can get gopher pellets, you know, that were mostly gopher, mouse pellets, but they're all from owls.
So owls might eat a mouse or a gopher and then get the food, the nutrients that he wants, and then he spits up this pellet.
Right, and then you can go underneath the tree and collect the pellets and dissect them and know what the owl's been eating.
My guest is Professor Roger Lederer, and his newest book, his eighth book, is Beaks, Bones, and Bird Songs: How the Struggle for Survival Has Shaped Birds and Their Behavior. Birds that we see in the air, they're often, we see them in flocks. And why do birds fly in flocks?
Well, they mostly fly in flocks during migration or during the wintertime. And they're doing that because, well, many more eyes can find predators. And they also can find food easier because they've got a lot more individuals looking for it. That's the main reason, protection and food finding. And sometimes they will huddle together at night in some place and share body warmth. They'll get together close on a wire or inside a barn or something like that.
Yeah, in fact, that often amazes me. Well, one thing, too, you say it's a certain shape. You can rely on this kind of pancake shape, the formation is. But when I see these teeny tiny little birds, and when I'm freezing to death, and I've got on a lot of clothes and layers of clothes, and I see these tiny little birds that have very little body mass, and they don't have any clothes other than their feathers, how do they do that, Roger?
You wear a down jacket and you find out. Down is very good insulator. They'll fluff it up, and that puts air pockets between all the different feathers, and you get even better insulation then. But in the wintertime, really cold and really windy, birds barely make it. They eat as much as they can at night, and then as soon as they wake up in the morning, they just start eating again. And something you can tell, there have been studies showing that the birds that haven't eaten very well don't sing in the morning, or they don't sing very much.
They don't want to waste any energy. They need all that
they have to eat first, and then they'll start singing. But if birds start singing at the first light, then obviously they've had enough, you know, the day before that'll last them until they start feeding again.
Well, I'd often wondered about that, how the birds stay warm. But you also cover in your book how they stay cool. And I hadn't thought about that, but when I read it, I thought, that's quite a problem for some birds, depending on where they are. So how do birds cool themselves?
So if you're wearing a down jacket and it's really hot, what would you do? You'd unzip it. Well, what they do is they fluff their feathers up again, only not just forming air pockets, but forming places where the air can get in. And so it just cools their skin. And they also pant. They have no sweat glands, so they'll pant very, very rapidly.
Yeah, in fact, I was surprised that panting applies to birds, but there was also something else that applied to birds that I didn't know that birds did. And what's this other way that they have? It's a word I didn't have even heard from, G-U-L-A-R.
Guler, meaning throat.
Guler flutter.
A number of birds do that. It's most obvious in pelicans and the cormorants that have distinct throat pouches, but you'll see parrots do it too. You'll see owls do it. They cause their throat to flutter, and the mucous membranes of the throat, just as we breathe out of our mouth when we're really trying to, or dogs pant, we're panting too. That increases their loss of heat off the inside of their mouth, in addition to panting.
So this is the way they can avoid overheating. Well, now what about, we humans have sweat glands. We cool ourselves that way.
Yeah, we have sweat glands. We also pant if it really gets bad.
Mm-hmm. But what about birds? Do they have sweat glands?
They don't have sweat glands. So, you know, their problem is compounded. Birds can withstand overall colder weather better than they can hotter weather. Birds will, you know, you find this out in like chicken ranches. Chicken ranches, sometimes they get really cold and a few birds will die. But if it gets really hot, a lot of them will die.
Yeah, I have
they
seen
get
that.
Overheated, and they just use up so much energy and lose their moisture so quickly.
My guest is Professor Roger Lederer, and he has studied how birds survive and their struggle for survival and how that shapes their behavior. And you have chapters on the flight, the migration, and how they navigate. How do birds navigate? How do they know where they're going?
That's been a mystery for a long time. You know, and some of the early stories were funny because Aristotle thought that birds, well, that swallows at least, dove into the mud and they just disappeared. And, you know, and then they came when they saw them over the water and they disappeared. I'll say must have gone into the water. And then next spring he sees them over the water again. Of course, the swallows are just getting insects and picking up water. But that was 300 BC, I think, Aristotle. That myth lasted until the 19th century. People were still talking about, and there were stories about fishermen dredging up swallows from the mud and how the mud would dry up and swallows would fly out. And then, you know, some guy actually wrote a book on how birds migrate to the moon. They go to the moon for the winter. But one of the earliest stories I like, which unfortunately didn't make it in the book, the editor took it out, but I liked it. It's called by the Aerostork or Aerostorch in German. They found out that some of the natives would shoot storks with spears or with arrows, and the storks would go to nest in Germany or in Austria, and they'd find these birds with the African arrows in them. So then they're called arrow storks, and they said they must have come from Africa. So some of the first indications that birds were not spending their place locally or going doing some silly thing, but they actually migrated across the Mediterranean.
You know, because of this fact that we don't know, we surmise, and it's our working theory for a while until we know better, I always wonder about dates when we say something is millions of years and this is millions of years. And I think, well, yeah, that's what we think now, but tomorrow that could be overturned as new evidence comes to light about all these various things that we learn about birds. Now, one thing that we know is we even have the expression, speaking of expressions about birds, scarce as hen's teeth, because hens don't have teeth. What about other birds? How do they deal with seeds? I mean, we have molars. If we eat a seed, we can chew that, we can grind down that molar for ourselves. But birds eat seeds, and they don't have teeth.
They have a palate, and their palate is a hard palate, especially in the case of sparrows. And those palates got little ridges in there. Our palate is pretty flat, but their palate has ridges. And they turn the seed one way and crack it, and they turn the seed another way and crack it a different way. So they know how to manipulate it. Watch the birds at your bird feeder. You'll see how they all manipulate those different kinds of seeds, and they And you know your bird feeder is full of shells of seeds.
And they're able to take the shell off those seeds. So birds eat seeds. What other kinds of, some birds eat pests, and you call those grazers. And it seems like that would be very helpful that, for example, if you have a rice crop, you want the birds that eat the pests.
Well, a lot of people have done that. In China, they've done it for years. They've used geese to go through the rice fields and pick up all the insects in there. I know some farmers here used to do the same thing. And then at the end of the season, they'd have their rice or they'd have their wheat, and they'd also eat their geese. it worked out well.
So then you have gleaners, and you say there are three ways to eat bugs. Three ways to eat bugs.
Well, there's lots of ways, but they tend to categorize it and, you know, just picking them off the ground or picking them off a leaf or flying through the air and catching them in midair. And I think I mentioned a talk the other night that when my first research project was trying to see how flycatchers caught flies in midair. I took motion pictures, 400 frames a second, so it could slow them down. You could see how birds caught insects, and at least these flycatchers caught them in the tip of their bills.
Well, I was amused by the fact that you say there's verdins might hang upside down so they could see the underside of leaves in case there are insects on the bottom side of a leaf. This bird could turn himself upside down.
You know, chickadees do that too, and nuthatches will do that. And there are some birds in the tropics that only look at dead leaves. They don't pay attention to live leaves because dead leaves actually have more bugs on them, because they are dying and decomposing. There are some birds that only look at curled up leaves because these curled up leaves indicate there's a caterpillar inside. So this, in the tropics at least, they specialize on the kind of leaves that they're eating off of.
Well, speaking of specializing, this is something that birds couldn't have done a couple of hundred years ago, and that is scavenge in parking lots. When cars go in, say the owner stops, he's been on the road, he stops to eat lunch, and why would birds be interested in that person's car?
Well, because all the bugs they pick up in their radiator, I've seen that many times. House sparrows, starlings, sometimes pigeons do that. But interesting enough, in Death Valley, which is very hot, birds don't pick up insects off the radiators. They pick them off the license plates because the radiators in Death Valley are too hot.
Too hot. And the birds know that.
They've learned that. Yeah.
They've learned that. So we've got all these different things that they might eat, and they're adapted to be able to eat those kinds of things. You say that there is a Florida scrub jay. He eats acorns, and he hides the acorns. But if another bird sees him hiding that acorn, what does he do?
Well, he'll hide it. He'll come back and pick up that acorn and hide it somewhere else. But he'll only do that if he actually is an acorn robber himself. So if he's unethical and he sees somebody there, figures he's unethical too, so I better hide it. But if he's honest, he presumes the other bird's honest as well.
I found that so amusing that the scrub jay will attribute his own motives to another scrub jay.
Yeah, it shows they're not bird brains at all, at least not in that case. Of course, jays and crows are the smartest of all birds that we've tested.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of reports about how crows know to, say, put something on the street. If they want the nut cracked, the car runs over it.
Yeah, crows and magpies will do that, yeah.
Birds have these, of course, they're a lot different from us. We assume, I think, similarities until we learn how different birds are. And one thing that we humans do not have is gizzards. And I recently read that I think it was right after World War II, when food had been scarce, you know, sugar, meat, rationed. So they're having this distinguished guest over. This young man was 9 years old at the time. And they were going to have chicken. And the young man was thinking, well, okay, I guess I get the leftovers. All the adults are going to get the nice pieces. And they asked the guest, sir, what part of the chicken would you like? And he said, the gizzard. And that, it was a surprise to the young boy. What in the world is a gizzard?
Well, the gizzard is just a muscular part of the stomach. The first part of the stomach is really very hard, very muscular. So when birds are eating seeds, eating pine needles, things like that, they're not very easily digested. There's little rocks or little stones inside the gizzard that roll around and crush these things. In fact, mother quail tells little young, and the way she tells them is to pick up little stones in your gizzard to get your life started.
Well, now, at Christmas time and Thanksgiving, people eat turkeys, and I'm thinking people will probably pass up the gizzard.
Well, it's in Indonesia, it's actually a delicacy.
Well, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. And your book has no filler in it. I mean, every page I could find fact after fact. This is, oh, wow, I didn't know that. So thank you for writing this book, Professor.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I enjoyed it.
My guest has been Professor Roger Lederer. His newest book is Beaks, Bones, and Bird Songs, How the Struggle for Survival Has Shaped Birds and Their Behavior. Roger Lederer was instrumental in launching the Gateway Science Museum when he was dean of the College of Natural Sciences at Chico State University. Next weekend, at the Barnes & Noble Bookstore in Chico, there will be a book fair to benefit the Gateway Science Museum. On November 26th, 27th, and 28th, Barnes & Noble will donate a percentage of sales to the museum. Just let them know when you check out that you want to support the museum with your purchase. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.